ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 13th of November. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. It's expected the Federal Liberal Party will formally dump its net zero carbon emissions policy today, following a lengthy party room meeting yesterday. A majority of Liberal MPs spoke in favour of ditching it after months of internal brawling over the climate policy. Samantha Dick reports.
By lunchtime today, Australians will finally know if the Liberal Party will keep or abandon a net zero target. After yesterday's marathon party room meeting, where more than half of the speakers called for the target to be ditched, the Shadow Ministry will convene this morning to resolve the party's final position. Liberal MP Scott Buchholz described the meeting as productive.
It's been a long time since the party room sat down and had a full and frank conversation like that with everyone. And went through alphabetically, everyone got a crack at making a contribution.
The opposition's climate change and energy spokesman Dan Tehan presented a list of principles aimed at shaping the party's policy development. They included ensuring a stable, reliable energy grid, which provides affordable power, and to reduce emissions in a responsible, transparent way that ensures Australia does its fair share. They also included scrapping carbon taxes, tariffs or mandates, but remaining in the Paris Agreement, an international treaty committing to limit global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius. Liberal frontbencher Alex Hawke says the party room broadly agreed with many of the principles.
Oh, look, there was a lot of consensus around the principles that Dan Tehan's outlined. I think that was good. Some disagreement about some elements, but tomorrow we're going to be discussing that in Shadow Cabinet.
Mr Tehan says he'll present a paper to the Shadow Ministry today.
And then myself and Susan will stand up after that Shadow Ministry and formally announce our policy.
With the Liberal Party all but certain to scrap the words net zero from their energy policy, Redbridge pollster and former Labor strategist Cos Samaras says the party's next challenge is to explain what they want instead.
The challenge is for them to basically try to articulate this very complicated, convoluted matrix that they've thought up. As they compromise, that keeps their coalition together.
Mr Samaras says many young voters already don't trust the coalition to deliver meaningful action on climate change.
The tone in which they've engaged in this debate has not been great over the last decade. And they've developed, as I've touched on before, a brand for themselves, which is one that they are always in the business of challenging climate policy.
Some polling has shown about a third of Australians were in favour of scrapping net zero, but the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry supports keeping the target. The CEO, Andrew McKellar, says businesses need certainty and detailed policy settings to confidently invest.
Business needs to see a clear plan. The detail is what's important here. So, you know, we need to understand, you know, where are we going in terms of future emissions abatement.
Those concerns are echoed by Australian Industry Group CEO Innes Willox.
Doubt around energy and emissions policy and approaches going forward, you know, just makes those investment decisions harder for businesses to make.
The Liberals' final position on net zero is expected to be known this afternoon.
Samantha Dick there. Australians are waiting more than 6 years to see specialists like neurologists in some parts of the country. Doctors are warning people are suffering irreversible complications and even risk dying while languishing on public waiting lists. But the full extent of the problem's unknown, with only some states routinely publishing this important information. National Health reporter Stephanie Dalzell has the story.
Show us how strong you are. How far can you go? I'm waiting.
Navigating the complexities of the health system is as familiar to Kylie Goldsborough as helping her son William scale his play equipment at their Gold Coast home. William was born very premature and spent several weeks in neonatal intensive care. He was diagnosed with hearing loss at the age of 2, and Kylie was shocked to learn there'd be a lengthy wait to see a public specialist.
At least 3 years, but potentially longer. It was unacceptable. It was unacceptable for a child that had already been through so much.
The ABC has analysed the longest available waiting times for public specialists across the nation. In South Australia, some people are waiting more than 6 years to see neurologists, and in Tasmania, it can take more than 3 years for urgent appointments with neurosurgeons meant to be seen within 30 days. While in Victoria, there are waits of more than 3 years to see ear, nose and throat surgeons. Clinical Professor of Medicine at the University of Sydney, Graham Stewart, described the figures as heartbreaking.
Well, as a clinician, I'm deeply offended by it. Each statistic is a person who's waiting for essential care way beyond the time that is clinically appropriate, and that carries with it the risk of preventable death.
Outpatient clinics in public hospitals are run by the states and territories, but receive federal funding as part of a broader public hospital funding deal. Associate Professor Raitt says the Commonwealth needs to step in and better resource the clinics, which are leaving too many people without care.
Clearly, we'd like to think in a society such as Australia, a so-called rich country, that we can actually deliver, you know, a first-rate health care system. And unfortunately, Australia doesn't actually do that well in terms of equity.
In a statement, a Federal Health Department spokesperson said the Commonwealth was investing a record amount in public hospitals and that managing specialist waiting lists was a responsibility of the states. While the states and territories told the ABC they are working to reduce public specialist waiting times, but not quickly enough for Kylie Goldsborough, who ultimately had to pay for William, who's now aged 4, to see a private specialist who organised crucial surgery.
It was a life-changing moment. We hopped in the car and it was raining and he's like, what's that noise? And it was the pitter-patter of the rain on the car roof that he could hear for the first time. There was just a genuine happiness that this one thing had worked out really well.
Mother Kylie Goldsborough, ending that report by Stephanie Dalzell and Selena Edmonds. In the United States, Democrats have released emails that raise new questions about President Donald Trump's relationship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and how much Mr. Trump knew about Epstein's abuse of underage girls. Our America's editor, John Lyons, is in Washington. John, this issue is not going away for the president. Can you take us through what these emails say?
Well, Sabra, the ghost of Jeffrey Epstein has been hovering in different forms over the White House for some time, and then it goes a bit quiet for a while, but it has re-emerged quite dramatically in the last few hours. The Democrats released three particular emails from Jeffrey Epstein, and then to try to almost swamp those, the Republicans in the House of Representatives have just released a trove of 23,000 pages of documents from the estate of Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted sex offender. And essentially, the ones that the Democrats have released, and people haven't had a chance to go through the 23,000 pages yet, but the ones that have caused the new pressure on the White House are one from Jeffrey Epstein to his longtime assistant, Ghislaine Maxwell, where he says, I want you to realize that dog that hasn't barked is Donald Trump. And then he mentions the name of a particular victim and says that she spent hours at my house with him, with Donald Trump. Now, that's quite dramatic because Ghislaine Maxwell, a few weeks ago, when she was interviewed by the US Department of Justice, suggested that Donald Trump had in fact not been to Epstein's house at all. And there's a second email where Jeffrey Epstein says to the journalist Michael Wolff, of course he knew about the girls. That's Donald Trump. Of course he knew about the girls. So those two emails have suddenly brought this whole issue back into the front line of the US media. And in fact, the White House spokesperson, Caroline Levitt, has addressed it a short time ago.
These emails prove absolutely nothing other than the fact that President Trump did nothing wrong. And what President Trump has always said is that he was from Palm Beach and so was Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein was a member at Mar-a-Lago until President Trump kicked him out because Jeffrey Epstein was a pedophile and he was a creep.
And John, a new congresswoman is about to be sworn in, and that could see the Epstein files a step closer to being released, all of them.
That's right, Sabra. As part of the gridlock, the shutdown of the last few weeks, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has refused to swear in a woman called Adelita Grijalva from Arizona. Now, the Democrats are saying the reason for that is because she is quite strongly of the view that all the Epstein files should be made public. Now, when they have her, once she's sworn in, in the next few hours, then the Democrats will have the numbers to be able to force the release of the Epstein files, which is something that Donald Trump has not wanted. And he has said, listen, I've done nothing wrong, but I think it's historic now, and I don't think it will add anything much to the sum of human knowledge to have it all released. But now it's looking more and more like all of the Epstein files, on top of these 23,000 pages of documents, it looks like all the Epstein files will be released. And I think there are some very nervous, powerful people in the United States.
John Lyons there in Washington. Australia's National Mental Health and Suicide Prevention Agreement is not effective, not fit for purpose, and urgent actions required to help an estimated 500,000 Australians who need help and aren't getting it. They're the scathing findings from the Productivity Commission, the federal government's independent economic advisor. It's reviewed the agreement between the federal, state and territory governments and says it's not led to better outcomes. Angela Jackson is a Productivity Commissioner and she joined me earlier. Angela Jackson, this report says the costs and waiting times are a major barrier for people trying to get care, that crisis support is inadequate, that 500,000 people need help and can't get it. Were you shocked by this?
Look, certainly I think what I was shocked by was the lack of progress that we've seen under this agreement. I think we've understood SABRE for a long time now that our mental health system isn't meeting the needs of those experiencing poor mental health and their families, or those with suicide ideation, but that there hasn't really, and while I think there's that recognition from government, and this agreement showed that, that there was a recognition for a need for action, for a need for a new approach, for a whole of government approach. We saw the treasurers come together indeed and sign this agreement in recognition of that, that there hadn't really been the progress under this agreement. I think we have recognised for a long time, as I said, the needs in the community, the experience of people with mental health, that it's not good enough. And what we really heard through this review from community providers, from people experiencing this on the ground, is that enough is enough, that they really need the actions now that are going to bring around the changes and improve the system.
Yeah, the Commission heard from people and families about patients falling through the cracks. Many listening to you this morning will wonder, are people unnecessarily dying because of this government sort of inaction?
Look, Sabra, that's always a difficult line to draw. And, I think we need to be careful around that. And there are individual circumstances. But certainly it's true that the fragmentation means that people going through the system don't experience the care that they need when they need it. It means that people are therefore experiencing worse outcomes than they would if the system was there to support them when they needed it. And we do see and continue to see rates of suicide higher than they should be, and they're not coming down. And in fact, for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we've seen recent increases. So we do need to look again at the system. The system is fragmented, and it's fragmented for, historical reasons. We have, both Commonwealth and state governments providing services, the private and the public provision. It's not working together to create a person-centred system that really meets people's needs.
This report points out, as you've just pointed out too, in regards to Indigenous suicide, that many actions in the agreement are not funded. For example, on closing the gap targets, governments have committed to align their responses, but there are no specific national measures or funding to improve services. This sounds like a recipe for failure.
Look, indeed. And I think really, our main conclusion here is this agreement, it set lofty ambitions. And as I said, there is a general view out there and a general acceptance that things need to change. But in this agreement, we've just not seen the actions that will actually lead to that change. And what we're saying is, look, for the next agreement, we need to do this well and we need to do it properly. We need to sit down, agree, including with people with lived and living experience, what we're trying to actually achieve, and make sure it includes the actions that are actually going to get us there. At the moment, the system really is, and there's reasons for that, obviously, Sabra. There is a lot of stress in the system. There's a lot of unmet need. People tend to flail around in those circumstances. But what we really need is strategic action to get the changes that actually deliver the system that will allow people experiencing mental health and suicide ideation and alcohol and other drug issues to really start to turn things around, and we create a system that supports people, that centres people's needs, and that delivers better outcomes.
Is it possible to fix? Do governments get the urgency? $360 million a year is spent on this agreement. Is that enough?
Look, that's one of the things we do, you know, and it's always, you know, how much will be enough? Look, overall, governments are spending around $12 billion a year on mental health and suicide prevention services. So there is a lot of money in the system. I think a lot of it is around the way it's spent, the way our services are designed. Of course, it's possible to do better, but we do need to, you know, continue to push for that reform and for that change and ensure that when we do have these agreements, and as I said, the agreement itself, in terms of, you know, what it was trying to achieve, its objectives, were fantastic. You know, whole of government approaches, integrated care, centering the people with lived experience, but the actions had absolutely nothing to do with meeting those objectives. And so we do need greater accountability. And that's a key thing that we're also recommending, that the next agreement has much clearer accountability structures in place, has targets, it reports on those outcomes over time so that we can really track how the system's going, how the reforms are going.
Angela Jackson, thanks for joining AM.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Sabra.
And Angela Jackson is a Productivity Commissioner. It's every young band's dream to play on a big festival stage. That goal can feel further away for bands in far-flung regions. For metal band Gnawa on South Australia's far west coast, those sentiments are familiar as it prepares to travel 800 kilometres to play a gig in Adelaide. Duncan Bailey reports from Port Lincoln.
In the far western South Australian town of Ceduna on the Eyre Peninsula, heavy metal band Gnawa are gearing up for their first capital city show in Adelaide. 20-year-old guitarist Callan Slattery says it's a big moment for the rural band, who will travel 800 kilometres to play a 40-minute set.
So a round trip from here is around 16 hours, and doing that sort of a trip for a 40-minute show to some people might seem a little extreme, but, you know, for us, it's a thing we've got to do.
Callan Slattery describes Ceduna as having a decent local music scene, but he says there aren't many options for a metal band.
But it's all more so around the sort of poppy, more country side of stuff. So it's hard to end up on the same bill as a lot of that sort of thing.
While the journey to Adelaide will be long, the heavy metal musician says it's just part of life on the far west coast.
Even just getting the name out there in bigger places where people will see us is going to be difficult. As long as we stick with it, which we're planning to, we should get there. Eventually.
Trooper J Core, another night on the waves with your host, Jack Bergen.
Jack Bergen is the host of Core on Triple J, the station's flagship heavy music show. He spent more than a decade touring as the vocalist in hardcore band Void of Vision and agrees it can be especially hard for regional bands to get exposure.
I think it's very limited what you can do in a regional town. There's only it's quite a niche genre that, especially in heavy music, where you can only meet a handful of people and you've kind of reached your ceiling quite early on in terms of that.
Jack Bergen says he's seeing renewed interest in regional touring.
I know that regional touring in a larger aspect for some of our more household names is coming back big. If we can keep continuing to sort of reintroduce these smaller towns and have more of these flagship acts come through, a lot of the locals will see that and they will respond to that.
400 kilometres south of Ceduna in Port Lincoln, Mike Pearson is preparing for a busy summer of shows.
Any venue in the regions is important, and the alternative ones obviously are great to sort of showcase some different genres, different types of music and original music at the same time.
Mike Pearson's venue Sound City sees artists crossing through Port Lincoln from all over the country.
It's sort of the nursery for the whole music industries, reducing the number of venues that alternative bands can play in. Well, the obvious effect, they've got nowhere to play, so they sort of have to invent their own gigs.
For Mr. Slattery and the members of Gnawa, the vast distances across the regions isn't enough to keep them from chasing their dreams.
I don't think we've gotten to the too much or too expensive part yet, but even if we do, I don't think we're going to be that fussed. I think we're just going to keep doing it. I think we're all wanting to do it enough that we'll just try and work through anything we can.
Ceduna guitarist Callan Slattery, ending that report by Duncan Bailey in Port Lincoln. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The longest government shutdown in American history is coming to an end. Today, political scientist Charles Hunt from Boise State University on why a small group of Democrats ended up giving Donald Trump exactly what he wanted. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.